Hi, it's Dr. Craig here, and in this episode, I interview my friend Guido Ciron. And Guido is based in Holland now, and he's a football coach, but much more than that. He's got a master's in sports science and now studying postgraduate work in psychotherapy, actual body-orientated psychotherapy, and we speak about this, but also his journey in football, working around different nations. But it doesn't matter if you're involved in football or anything, this is a real focus on human performance. And Guido is a great guy, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Okay. Hi, everyone. It's Dr. Craig here. I've got my friend here, Guido Ciron, all the way from Holland, which is really good. And just a bit of background, I first met Guido back in 2015, and he's a football coach and has a sports science background as well. So we met in Qatar, wasn't it? Yes. In Doha. And at that time, he was working in UAE, but has worked in Saudi Arabia, worked in South Africa, and now back in Holland. So I thought it'd be great to have Guido on because he's a really good guy, very interesting. I suppose similar in some respects to a path I've taken, where our background is the sports science and football specifically, but then now has a real interest in body-orientated psychotherapy, and so broadening out. So I was really excited to talk to him. We caught up last week, which was fun as well, and just found out how each of us are going during this COVID period. So we'll just have a chat and then go from there. How are you, mate?
Yeah, good. Thanks for the invitation. Happy to have a chat again.
Yeah. Well, give me a little bit of background. I mean, let's start with your origin story. So how did you get involved in you know, what led you to where you are now?
Well, I mean, obviously I started playing soccer when I was, or football, like we call it over here, when I was six. Tried to get through the ranks, playing for a small amateur team, and then unfortunately I tore my ACL when I was 17. If I look back at that time, from a sports science perspective, I was training five times a week. In my last year of high school, coaching the under nines and under tens at Saturday morning, playing my own game Saturday afternoon, and then playing indoor futsal games in Saturday evening. And then I had to start at the second reserve team on Sunday morning. So that combination, I didn't have any time to work. So I thought like, okay, I'll bring around the newspaper at 6:30 each day, except Sunday, to get some money in.
Yeah.
But that whole combination just led to many, like, overall fatigue. And then if I look back at it now from a sports science perspective, it's not, how you say it, it's obvious that that some kind of injury from a central nervous system perspective would occur.
And so, and had you been injured before? Were you getting...
No major injuries, just like maybe a groin strain once, but and maybe some ankle sprains every now and then, but yeah, that's about it. So
yeah. Okay. And then from there, did you go straight after high school into university to start studying?
Well, they call, over here, it's not they have a different system than like in Australia. It's not called a university, but you can still do a bachelor. It's more University of Applied Sciences, like they call it. It's not really a university where you can go straight on to a master's. So that got, I started doing that besides the coaching that I started when I was 16. So I did a bachelor's in sports science. I had a 5-year rehab period with another 3 operations. So that's, and then I was like, okay, let's just focus on sports science only. And I was training with someone who had a master's in sports science. So that's how I got interested in doing a master's as well.
Mm. And how did that affect you? So you had three. So you had the original ACL surgery. What were the next two surgeries?
Well, it took me a year to find out my ACL was torn. So I lost a bit of trust in the medical people around me at that time. And then the first time it was a meniscus operation, and then they saw, okay, we have to do the ACL as well. So that was two operations, and then I had another not a meniscus injury and an ankle operation. So it was the same side that was affected, and so I had a bit of going up and down. It was really tough, and also making the decision to stop playing football wasn't easy. Felt more like it was a forced decision than something and that I really wanted.
Yeah, and how were you psychologically? Because that's a crucial time, isn't it? You know, around that 17, 18 sort of years. Did you suffer from that?
Yeah, definitely. But I didn't stand still with it. So I was just going through, okay, if I just train, I'll get back. And if I'm honest, a few years later now, I think I stopped playing when I was 23. I'm 32 now, and I didn't really stop and realize what was happening. So my body was still giving me signals like, hey, there's some tension here that you need to give attention to, which I'm still experiencing now, which is interesting if we come back to the body-oriented psychology later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. And then did you think when you're going through your playing years that you would study sports science, or did you think about that you would go into coaching?
I was already doing coaching before I got the injury, and I was thinking of getting a PE teacher education, but because of the injuries, I went a different route, so more the sports science direction, because I wasn't going to be a PE teacher until retirement, so I knew I was going to do something on the side already.
Yeah, okay, all right, excellent. So tell me, where was your first overseas appointment to?
I actually wanted to do my research internship at Liverpool John Moores University because they have at that time it was the only bachelor in science and football they had over there. So I went over to do some research together with Martin Littlewood and looking at microstructures of practice. So in combination of the theoretical side, I also wanted to do some practical internship. So that's when I managed to do an internship with the first team of Tranmere Rovers. So that was in 2012-13,
And how was that experience?
That was very interesting experience. Also coached the men's university football team and some under-8 kids. Like at that time, I didn't really learn from my injury before. I was just going full gas. Full gas, as they say in Germany, which are our borders over here.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Doing the internship, doing my master thesis, doing the coaching the under-8s, coaching the university football team.
100 miles an hour.
100 miles an hour, just going through it until my best friends came over and they were like, if you put your foot off the pedal, maybe you can enjoy it a little bit more. And they were putting a mirror in front of me and I didn't like it at that time, but they were right. They were right.
Are you one that finds it hard to relax and enjoy life as such?
At that time, more than I do now, because I really wanted to go somewhere. I was hoping to get a job in professional football in England. So I was just going for that goal, but blocking all the outside issues.
Now you grew up under the Dutch system. Now the Dutch system is recognized worldwide as probably the best development system. I know in Australia it's revered, you know, the how the Dutch coach and play and all that. What's your perspective of that as being a coach, but also being from Holland? Did you recognize, or do you believe it's a system that's far ahead of others?
It was, but then we took that for granted, in my opinion. I did my UEFA C license when in 2009, 2010. And then I got back after 6 years abroad doing my UEFA B license, and they were still using the same books and methodology and presentations.
Okay, all right.
But the price went up, but the content stayed the same. Pretty critical about the current system. UEFA A license costs about 10,000 euros. And if I'm honest, if I look at the content now, I'm not willing to pay that for myself.
Yeah, I understand. And do you think the Dutch system, I suppose it was it, you know, Cruyff that revolutionized it, and yeah. And everything that came with that, even from 74, I mean, 78, I suppose.
Yeah.
And you just think it got to a point and then it stopped evolving.
Yeah, a little bit, because the countries around us, like Belgium, Germany, they looked at our system and said, okay, what have they done? And then we stood here and then they did this. Mm. So that's how I perceive it, because I managed to work with a few Belgium coaches when I was abroad in Saudi. And in my opinion, that was a bit further than the Dutch educational football system was at that time. Mm. But hopefully now they're trying to evolve it a little bit. I think from a grassroots perspective, compared to a country like Australia, we're miles ahead of Australia.
Yeah.
In terms of structure that's there, definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a very good thing about being in Holland and working in football as a youth coach.
Yeah. So expand on that a little bit. So you mean a long way ahead, just the quality of play, the understanding. So the kids really understand tactically how to perform.
Yeah, I mean, they play. I mean, not as much as we used to do, but they played it on the streets on their PlayStation. I think they watch it a bit more often than the kids do in Australia because of the time difference with the Champions League games, etc. So they're more exposed to, I think, structured training, which can also be too much. Structured training is also not good, but mm-hmm. At least they know how to learn. They learn how to play the game.
Yep.
But sometimes it's too coach-centered. But I know a few guys at the Dutch FA trying to evolve from that to going more towards a player-centered coaching system. And there are a lot of clubs that have their own artificial fields. So the possibilities for a kid to play football around any city is very close.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so from England, you finished off in England, and then you went to, where was the next trip to?
That was Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Working as a youth coach and as a sports scientist with the under-9s all the way up till on the 15s.
Yeah, with the national federation.
No, that was a club, Al Ahly Saudi. They also played the Asian Champions League against the Western Sydney Wanderers.
Yes, yes.
The year before that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and
so,
and how did that come about, that trip?
Well, I managed to visit Dave Tenney in Seattle a few times, and that's where I met a Belgian guy, Jan van Winkel,
yes.
at the conference, and he offered me the job later on.
Ah, isn't it great? And I think that's a really important point that I say to a lot of people is these relationships that you make. And being a good person, I think, really helps, because Jan is a very experienced person. And so he would have noted that. And then when something came up, and it's just that relationship and that chance meeting that actually made that situation happen. And in Saudi, you got to work with a friend of ours, Eric, that was good.
Yeah.
And a successful Belgium coach that had been national technical director in Australia as well. So how was that experience working with Eric?
Very good, very good. I mean, he was a very nice guy as well. And I mean, the way he approached players, and he also had a lot of experience coaching kids, not just from a football perspective. I mean, I learned a lot from him, more so from a relationship, man management perspective than from a football perspective.
Yeah, and a very nice man as well. Yeah. I talk about that a lot, but I know the more I go through this, I know people get by that mightn't be that nice of people, but I just choose, you know, good people. I think they end up, at the end of the day, it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And how was the Saudi experience in general?
That was very good. I mean, going to a country that it's totally different culture.
Yeah.
You don't speak the language, so you don't know what the kids are talking about. I was coaching 8s and 9-year-olds, and they don't really realize that you don't speak the same language. So they just start having a conversation with you, and they don't really, why is he not responding? Like,
Yeah. And what was the quality like then?
In my opinion, very good. I think that's one of the best youth academies in Saudi. And if I look back at it now, I think two or three players that were currently at that time, they were on a 14, 15, now signed a contract with the first team. And I think the main issue was the structure. So we managed to build a better structure of talent selection and identification. And then the under-15s was the only team that played a championship. But the under-14s and younger, they didn't play any competitive games.
How do you feel about that? Because, Australia is a very competitive nation. And people find it very difficult when it was sort of brought in that there was no competition for under-8s, under-9s, under-10s. Yep. I think parents struggled with it. Everyone sort of struggled at the grassroots level. What's your thinking about it?
I was happy they did that in Saudi because on the 15s, we had a staff of 8 people around the team and we had a meeting before and after each game. So winning was very important over there. So I was happy they didn't do that with the younger ones. And in Holland over here, they now also don't really keep score with the under 12s and younger also.
Yeah.
However, they still put it out on social media and they still keep scores after each block of 20 minutes that they've played. And I think from a player perspective, I think you always want to win the game.
Yeah.
But from a coach perspective, the way the pyramid is built, the higher salaries are with the higher age groups. So the way you can work yourself up through the ranks as a coach is to get a good, how do you say it? If you can compete well with your team.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the way people look at you from the outside is the way you're going to be perceived. So that's how you can work your way up. So I think that from that point of view, it's very good. So that coaches don't really use the kids to work their way up the ranks, if you understand what I'm saying.
I understand. How do you think it impacts competitiveness? Is it hard for kids? Have you seen any change in that? You know, we go from a place where there's no so-called competition and then the next year there is competition, you know, where points do matter, where winning and losing does matter. Have you seen any change in the desire and competitiveness in kids as compared to when you were playing?
Good question. I don't really see a difference, but the teams that I work with now with Fortuna Sittard, they lose a lot of games. So that I can see back in their psychological behavior.
Yeah.
And then the next game or the next league game is going to be more important because they've lost so many games. Whenever are we going to win a game again? So then the kids feel pressured. I think it's not only from themselves, but also from the social environment. Because I see kids freeze nowadays when we play league games. But to be honest, when I was playing, I wasn't playing in a professional club. So I don't know what kind of stress or they are really perceiving. I think the younger ones, I mean, you have kids, they want to win anyway. So, and they hate to lose.
Yeah, the best ones, I think, they have that intrinsic motivation. They don't need that outside points table or anything like that. I have found that there is a real relationship with people that just have that intrinsic desire to be as good as that they can be. And I think that's really important. So from Saudi, then where was next?
I was planning to do a PhD in Sydney, actually, with Donna O'Connor, looking at the microstructure of play, but unfortunately, as you know, the scholarship system isn't easy for a foreigner in Australia, so I didn't get through the application process. So I managed to go to Dubai as head of sports science of the academy and assisting on the 19s for 1 year, but compared to Saudi, the structure over there wasn't as good, the level of play wasn't as good, so, but from a social perspective, after living 2 years in Saudi Arabia, I could enjoy life a little bit more and do things that I liked.
Yeah, I think Saudis are really, I've been recently doing some presentations for the Saudi Federation. I've got a friend that is the head of education there and he's fantastic. There's a real desire to learn there. I see with the Olympic Committee and even the country is advancing, isn't it? Just from some of the from a point of view of social sort of aspects of the country is really advancing. I did find there was a definite difference playing, you know, national teams, playing against the Saudi national team to the UAE national team. They seem, even though I think they're sort of related, you know, they're closest countries, there seem to be, maybe I'm wrong, but a bit more desire with the Saudis.
Yeah, definitely. And there's more, I mean, if you look at the games, how many people attend the games in UAE, it's not much, maybe 1,000 max to the games there. From the first team that I was the club I was working for. If you go back to Saudi, we had a stadium that could host 60 to 70,000 people. And for the local derby, that was full. It was packed. And if I would go to the supermarket with my club jersey on, hey, they would recognize me. And in UAE, in Dubai, it wasn't like that. So there's a lot of potential for football in Saudi, in my opinion. The only thing that they lack at the moment is structure at the younger age groups. I think a lot of talent is wasted because of that.
It's a really good point, and it's interesting because Bert van Marwijk was at Saudi with Mark van Bommel and Roo Koemans, who I've worked with as well, and they did very well with the Saudi national team. They ended up not taking them to the World Cup and took Australia to the World Cup, but they spoke very highly. And then recently they worked with the UAE national team, and I think that was a much different job, in respect to the players. So it is interesting. You'd think UAE would have the potential as well, but they need structure.
Yeah, but I think also if you look at the way that the countries live by, I mean, the locals don't really have to work hard to get something.
No.
And that sound maybe very harsh, but I mean, that's the way I perceived it. But in Saudi, there are also poor Saudi people that still can play very good football.
Yeah. And the same, I think, in Qatar as well. You know, the Qatari, you know, if you're a Qatari person, you live very well. Right? Yeah. And I think it's interesting in that respect that they... how that infiltrates into actual football.
Yeah, that's what I learned when working abroad. The culture of the country has a massive impact on on the way that you have to work at a club.
Yeah, and so after UAE, you went to South Africa?
Correct, yeah. Yes. I managed to work with John Kamitis. We had he talked to me before I went to Dubai. He wanted to buy a club in the PSL in South Africa because it's a franchise system, and then move it to Cape Town. So when he managed to do that, I actually was the first person he talked to, and it was like, okay, let's build something from scratch. So the only thing we had was like 11 players. That was it. Yeah. We had to start with it, building our own training facility, club offices, looking to build a new brand, which he's very good at. If you look at Twitter and look for Cape Town City FC, you'll find that their social media and their branding is actually very good.
Yeah.
So that was a very good experience.
Yeah, tell me, a nice city, Cape Town?
Oh, definitely. You know, one of the beautiful cities in the world. Sorry for Sydney, but I mean, I managed to see both cities, but no, it's very cool.
Yeah, and tell me about that experience. So you're working with the first team there?
Yeah, I was the head of sports science and performance. So my plan was to build a sports science department. So not only for the first team, but also from the top down. Mm. So we had a first team and second team. We managed to win one of the cups in the first half year because I had three cups over there. Mm. And then we finished third in the first season, which was great. So we could play like the equivalent of the Europa League, but then the qualification stages in Africa the year afterwards. So there in the second year we had to play 11 games in 44 days.
Right. Yeah. Very good.
So that was very interesting.
And what was the quality of the football?
Good question. I think there is a lot of potential in South Africa, especially from an individual skill perspective. Mm. It's very good because they play in the streets a lot when they're younger. Mm. From a team tactical perspective, I would say the tactical discipline is a bit less, especially in the last 20 minutes. then the game would be wide open and it could go either way.
And who was the first team coach when you were there?
The first year was Eric Tinkler.
Right.
And the second season it was Benny McCarthy.
Okay, good. And what...
Former South African player from the national team.
And how is that league developed now?
Obviously, they had some struggles with the COVID situation because the healthcare is not very well organized in the country over there. So I was a bit afraid that a lot of people would suffer because of that over there, not only because of the COVID situation, but because of the financial and economical consequences of it.
Yeah.
But I know they've got a different sponsor now. I hope they get over it. I mean, not get over it from a COVID perspective, but just I hope they can manage to maintain. So they finished the league in the summer. They had like a local bubble, which they created, same as the Champions League teams did in Portugal. So they managed to finish the season. And then, they are starting this week again, I think.
Okay. So you left there. What year did you leave there?
2018.
Okay, good. And then back to Holland.
Back to Holland because because of the knee and ankle issues, I was like, okay, let's go cycling. I don't cause any issues with my knee and ankle as much, but then I got a hip injury. So
I don't mean that. You're only 32.
exactly. I mean, I look younger, but my body probably is a little bit older than that. But at that time when I didn't have to work, I realized, wait a second, again, a moment where I was forced to stand still and think about, okay, what do I want to do next in my life? And I was working for 6 years abroad and I was missing my friends and family. And I was like, okay, I want to go further in the coaching, not just sports science route.
Mm.
And in the first year when I was in Cape Town, I actually managed to go to Sydney to do the coaching license there because I didn't have an option to do it somewhere else.
Mm.
And it was closely linked to the Dutch philosophy. And I realized in that week after I had my operation, like, listen, okay, I want to go further in coaching. If I want to do that, I need to get my UEFA licenses. And then going back home was a logical choice.
Okay. And you came back home to the club you're at now?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Which is?
Fortuna Sittard.
Yeah. Okay, good. Were you working with the first team or the academy?
Yeah. So I finished my job in Cape Town. I went back to Holland without actually having a job. The only thing I knew was, okay, I want to do my coaching qualification. And then Fortuna were looking for a first team physical coach.
Mm.
And I did that in combination with my UEFA coaching qualification.
Yeah.
One season.
Yeah. And how did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was very good. I mean... doing warm-ups at the field like the Feyenoord Stadium and Amsterdam Arena is like something, I mean, I dreamed of playing at when I was a kid. So those match days were really like, I was really in total element being young again. And like that field was top. Like,
yeah,
that was a very good experience.
Yeah. Which team did you support as a kid?
I used to grow up with Ajax Amsterdam, but after they lost the second Champions League final back in, I think, 97 or 98, I was going more looking for Roda Kerkrade because it was a bit closer and I could watch more games.
Mm.
So those two teams I've supported when I was younger.
Yeah, nice. And you're from the South. So
Yeah.
So explain the difference between the South and the, just for Australians listening, I understand there's quite a significant difference between the below the river and above the river. So tell me about
that. Yeah, it's funny. We actually talked about this last week. I think people above the rivers in Holland are a bit more straightforward than from the south. From the south, we're a bit more laid back.
Mm.
And a bit not really that straightforward, which can also be sometimes an issue because then you will have to find out what people think through different doors.
Yeah.
I think that would be the main difference. I think the work ethic above the rivers is also a little bit higher, I reckon. People tend to enjoy life a little bit more below the rivers, but that's the way I've perceived it. And the other thing is because we're like the southern part is like really in between Belgium and Germany. I have a feeling like the over here we don't really tend to perceive ourselves as Dutch people. So like people from above the rivers, they would say they're from Holland. People from the below the rivers, they would say I'm from the Netherlands.
Oh, okay. So explain that to me.
Yeah, well, obviously two of the provinces are called North and South Holland. And like I've said, like where you're from Holland, you're a bit more straightforward, a bit more, more to the point, a bit cocky at times, I think. From the South, we're a bit more laid back, more.
Okay, so you would say you're from the Netherlands. Yeah, interesting. And I had great experience, working with Roel Koomans and Mark van Bommel was just exceptional, and obviously Bert van Marwijk, who I think they all live down in the South. Now, even though I think Bert originally came from higher up, but they've talked very glowingly about the South, so it was really nice. And now you touched on the point, which is really good. You told me last week how you did your license in Australia and found it very good.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was looking for something that could relate a little bit to the Dutch philosophy and playing style.
Mm.
The way I really enjoyed is the way of teaching and the responsibility they give to the coach to develop their own way of working.
Yep.
Instead of this is the way you have to do it and make sure you stay within the lines.
Mm.
Michael Cooper was one of the teachers, and I really enjoyed his way of teaching, and which was new for me in ways of the way an FA would implement a coaching course.
Yeah, that's nice, and a little bit more problem-based learning or student-centered learning. Yeah, it's a nice model. I think they've done well with that. And what was also good is that you were able to become the educator in respect to the conditioning. Which was good because, a lot of that had been put together with what was perceived as a Dutch model. But you were able to sort of say, well, it's not exactly the way we do it in Holland.
Well, it's the way the FA does it. It's not the way the most clubs do it.
Yeah.
So people do it to get the license. That's basically what it is at the moment.
Yeah. So take us through what would be different in respect to football conditioning? Yeah. How do you see football conditioning?
Well, the way I see is like if you speak about training load, you have to look at those response relationship and the way they do it with the Verhagen methodology is just you're looking at the dose. They don't speak about response at all.
Mm.
And even if you don't have the GPS or the subjective wellness questionnaires that a professional club would have, you could still implement like a very easy method of a session RPE to monitor your training load and to get at least some kind of response of your players. Because in my way, if you play 3 times 11 minutes this week and you play 3 times 12, that's not a one-on-one correlation. The body is way too complex to predict that kind of correlation and development. Because the way I see it, talent development is non-linear. The body our human body is very complex and dynamic. So you have to work around that. You can't plan your periodization for a half year from the start until December. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that. I mean, I completely agree. And, I've been quite outspoken against certain models because simply for that exact reason, if you do not measure the response, it's not as simple as just saying, okay, well, this week we're doing three, exactly what you said, 11v11, 2 times 10 minutes, and then we'll increase it by a minute. It makes no sense to me because I think we need to be very agile with our planning based on the response. And looking at the day to day, it may need changes. I think that type of model works I don't know. I want to say it works well somewhere. I'm not sure where it does, but it's.
Well, you know. I know coaches that they're really happy with it because it works for them. So I would say continue doing that if it works for you. I don't want to break something that works for anyone.
Yeah.
But from a culture perspective, which we spoke about before, everybody's doing the same sessions, but you're working in a different club. You're playing in the different kind of style of play. How can you actually implement the same, football conditioning days at every club? And in my opinion, I actually wrote an article about that in Dutch. I hate the word football conditioning because in Holland, they say we do once a week, we do a football conditioning session, which I think is bullshit because each day that you train is some kind of football conditioning. You just alter the volume and intensity.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's very nice that you're saying this because I just, I totally agree. And I never understood football conditioning because it's just football. And you need to be physiologically, the modern game now, you need to be physiologically very good to be successful. And yes, of course, technical, tactical, psychological are an important part of the process. But I would say if you're not physiologically very, very good, that can limit to the level that you can play at. So I think we need to be aware of that. The other one I never understood was what was a football sprint.
Yeah, that's just running with the ball.
Yeah.
Basically put it in a football, so running with the ball and make sure there's a goal at the end of it.
Yeah. So no, it's really interesting. So when did you start getting interested in, like, I know we both have an interest in stoicism and reading, I suppose, outside of exactly what football is?
Yeah. Ooh, that's a very good question. I think I started doing that when I was working in Saudi Arabia, really. When you get in touch with different cultures, you try to open up for different kind of readings instead of just the theoretical frameworks and books that you've had at university. Mm. So I think I started really when I finished university. And maybe when I was trying to orient what I really wanted to do next, I think the main reason when I got in touch with stoicism is I think when I was in Cape Town and I was having the hip operation, which we spoke about last week, I had some arrhythmias of my heart afterwards, which was, okay, I was like, maybe it's because of the medications, but it was just because I was doing way too much and I didn't really realize and was standing still and listening to my body. And like, I was trying to find ways to manage myself better in a high performance environment, really. And I started journaling for myself and then I got in touch with a Daily Stoic. That's how I read it.
Yes.
Ryan Holiday. And from there on, I started reading those kind of books.
Mm. And how has it helped you?
It has helped me in a way that I could be a bit more rational. I don't know if that's the right English word, but see things from a different perspective and not get other things get to me, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The way I respond to things is my responsibility, not others. That's one of the main things that I've learned from it. But even still, I think it's... We slightly touched on it before we started recording that I think it's a very cognitive way of living. So you try to manage your thinking and then you hope you control your feelings and change your behavior because of that.
Mm.
But in my opinion, by just talking to yourself in a different way is not the only way to manage yourself better in high performance.
So when you were in... So you're in Cape Town, you have the surgery in Cape Town.
Yeah.
On the hip. And then, the arrhythmias. So you've got no real support there, I suppose.
Sorry, the connection was a bit...
So did you have... What sort of support did you have? Your family's a long way away and you've got these concerns with the heart and everything.
Yeah, well, my girlfriend was with me at that time. So that was only the only support I had besides the colleagues I had from work. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was an interesting time. So, and you started journaling. Now you mentioned Ryan Holiday. So you, I mean, I've got books in the background. So you've read all his books. And so you mentioned that, yes, Stoicism is very much a cognitive thing. And then this has led into the, you know, the body oriented psychotherapy and the interest in that. So we actually spoke offline about this, but tell me, and for everyone listening, tell me about that.
Well, when I started implementing Stoicism in my life and working life, really, it's like, okay, I just thought I found something that would help me to manage in that environment better, but I was not listening to the signals that my body was giving. So the way I view it, and the way that psychology research is also, you have like two ways of trying to implement change. So you have a top down or bottom up. So top down says, okay, you try to work your thinking and then you control your feelings and then you try to change your behavior because of that. But you can also do bottom up. So bottom up gives you, okay, I sense this, I feel this, and then I say what comes in mind, instead of working the other way around. I think there has to be some kind of combination, because just talking about things that you that are happening in your life without actually feeling or standing still with the signals that your body are giving you or telling you implicitly, I don't think you'll will ever be able to manage to change and then keep that change. If you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. So go back to this implicit, and because these are quite unique for all of us. So the implicit understanding of these body reactions.
Yeah, the way we actually had a class about this last weekend, so it's very cool to touch on this now again, is that the way we give meaning to things is in some way out of our control, because we learn that due to mirror neurons, so we try to see what other people do and see, okay, that's the kind of behavior, but then you also feel it. Same thing when you watch a movie, you can get angry or emotional because of what the movie is telling you, because of the mirror neurons in our brain. But the other thing is that when we're born and we don't really are able to give something meaning that we can do now with watching a movie, we still sense and make meaning of things due to our feeling system. And this also creates like a neuron network that learns us how to respond to certain situations. So that starts from when you're being born, but even before you're being born and you're still in the belly of your mother. So until your age of six, that's when your main emotional development is made. And so some kind of situations can give you gut feeling, but you can't really tell or give meaning to it. But that's a very implicit way of your body telling you something.
So the old concept, I have a gut feeling, is actually real. That's what you're...
Yeah, it is. The way the gut is perceived as your second brain.
Mm. So intuition would come into that as well?
Yeah, but the funny thing is, if you look from the Eastern philosophy, which is built around the chakra philosophy, which tells you that there are seven energy zones around your spine, they would tell you that intuition is more on this level. But other people would say intuition is based on your gut feeling, which is like moving what you feel like moving. And which is very interesting if you go back to football and the way the football is structured. If you look at personal development and authenticity, authentic movement, football, the structure of football doesn't allow for a person to develop authenticity, because we're always being told by the coach or by your parent what to do in a certain situation. If you look at dance, for example, there are certain dances that would go from a gut feeling bottom up, but the way we do things is top down. Now we have to do things because we're being told to do it and try to translate that to behavior, which is like the opposite of your personality development.
So if we use that dance analogy, like someone like Michael Jackson was very much just bottom up, just not structured, just felt what, and then danced. Footballers, are we talking like a Maradona would be more along those lines?
Or like maybe a Lionel Messi, for example. Yeah. He would react to certain situations instead of thinking, I'm going to do this. But it's very difficult to say that from outside of being someone else's body.
Yeah.
If you understand what I'm saying.
So football could look very different. Is there a space in football for this behavior, or do you think we need to be structured?
Well, in a way, it's a team sport, so you have to have some kind of structure to work together. But if you look at, especially when kids grow up and you want them to develop their own personality, like you also, like a club, you want to develop your own personality and style of play, you need to give some kind of freedom to develop their own persons. And I think if we have a more player-centered coaching structure, we would have that more than, no, that's not the way I told you to do things, kind of culture.
So how could we do this in football? If you're setting up a, you know, from what you know, from psychotherapy, from stoicism, from, you know, sports science, from your coaching, what do you think is a really good way to develop players?
I think you, at the younger age groups, you need to have coaches that can be very intuitive and go with their gut feeling and say, okay, what do you guys... I spoke to a guy who was actually working at the Dutch FA. So he sometimes goes to his girls' practice and asks the girls, okay, what do you want to do today?
Mm.
So then you go from the feeling of the players, okay, I want to work on this, I want to work on that. Instead of that, it's all structured from the club. No. This week we're working on attacking, next week we're working on defending, etc., etc. I would say we need to get a lot more buy-in input from the players in their own development. And then later on, obviously, when they get older, then we need to put things together and how is that going to work in a team.
Do you think we have a problem with the leadership? You know, that our leadership is, like I often say, football coaching is stuck in the industrial age of leadership. You know, it's transactional. You do this, you know, master servant. You do this because I say it. If you do not do this, you don't play. And then I always wonder when, and you would have been in these meetings when coaches go, we have no leaders on the field.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So we could. Okay, so if we talk about... from, you know, the cognitive to the body orientated development, if we're talking just about our lives and how to manage our emotions, how would you put sort of body orientated psychotherapy into action?
Well, I think the way the Western culture has been built, there's not enough room or space to actually work around and listen to your feelings because there's constant input. And I would say I would slow things down and, okay, if I would work with someone one-on-one in the coaching that I'm doing with my own business now, is that the first phase would be, okay, we go out, walk or for a jog and then actually stand still. How is it to be in your body today?
I like that.
Describe, what does it feel like? Where is the stiffness? So if I would take myself for an example, I had a lot of back issues and some stiffness and it felt like my body and my gut weren't aligned. And if I would look in the mirror, I could actually see that my head was a bit out of line. So if I stand still and I take the time for myself, I realize that the thing that we spoke about before, my injury and me stopping playing football, I haven't really... took enough time to stand still, what that has done to me. So now my body is telling me through some aches in my spine mainly and my hip and my knee also, that, okay, you need to listen to this. And back in the days, I mean, 4 or 5 years before this, I would just go to the physiotherapist, go to the osteopath, okay, you fix me so I can do my job again. But that's not the way... the long term, it's not going to work in the long term. So that's why I'm saying that stoicism or any kind of cognitive psychology therapy, it can you can manage this part, but if you don't learn to listen to your body and your feelings, you're not making the right decisions.
Yeah, okay, because you're just pushing them further down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it gets back to this. I see what you're saying, because it's getting back to giving yourself space to be in a quiet space. And I often think cognitively, so your mind, but you're saying to actually feel where your body is at as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's your body at? What's your body saying? Like, reflecting yourself. I know that when I'm not happy with myself or others, I get this frown like Frank de Boer has on his face as well. And so I actually wrote a blog about that recently, is that if I have this, then I'm not really open for players to, hey coach, I need to talk to you about this, or they, and then falling like this. So what I learned also with being abroad and not speaking the same language as the people that I work with, mm, is that body language is way more important than the normal language.
Mm.
Because that's the way we learned when we were kids. I managed to learn the Arabic language because of I could see something and then hear something. I was like, okay, that's what babies do as well.
Mm.
They see an action and then they try to put a word next to it.
Yeah, so would you suggest that if you change your body language, you can change your thoughts as well?
You can change your feelings. So if I'm not happy with myself and I'm sitting like this, mm, and then I go sit up like this, put a smile on my face, then already I'm feeling a bit better. So it works two ways.
Mm. Mm. No, it's really interesting. And I mean, you know, it was interesting to me when you spoke about it last week. Obviously, I've studied psychotherapy and psychology, but I hadn't really, you know, heard much about the body orientated psychotherapy. And it's interesting. So the course that you're doing now, how have you found it to be interesting? Yeah,
it's very interesting. Also, there's a lot of theory behind it, which is good for me.
Mm.
Because I come from a different route than the other people that are on the course, because those are mainly psychologists from a health perspective.
Mm.
So I think I'm the only one from a sport perspective.
Yeah.
But I find it very interesting. The other thing is that certain emotions, like if you're not energetic, for example, I would have low back issue. And now I learned that the energy zone is in your lumbar spine, in the like L4, L5 region.
Mm-hmm.
So, and before that, I would just go to the osteopath and, okay, I think I have an issue here. Can you fix it? He fixed it. But then a few weeks later, I was back. So he was happy to have me as a customer, but I wasn't like, there's a Thomas Davey, I think he's a Belgian guy. He says the symptom is never the problem. So the low back issue was my body telling me, hey, you're doing way too much, you don't have any energy, and emotional intelligence zone is in the same area. So if you're depleted from energy, you're more easy to snap at people, and you can't really feel other people what they need. So to give an example, when I was going 100 miles an hour in Liverpool and coaching a university football team, I was thinking, okay, they need structure, I want to learn them things, blah, blah, blah. But then after a few times, one of the players was open enough to tell me that, coach, we don't like the way you do things. And that's a slap in your face as a coach to hear that from your players. But I was happy that he said that, because they were just trying to have fun, to play, to have a training session on Monday evening and have a game on Wednesday. And after that, I changed my approach, but I wasn't aware of it before someone telling me that.
Mm. And so that explains, so there must be, you know, there's always, we know that mind-body relationship in respect to sickness as well. You know,
definitely.
Stress leads to, you know, to problems. And I was speaking to a friend of mine, a physiotherapist yesterday, and saying how, you know, how much pain impacts us more when we're under stress. You know, that we will feel when we're euphoric and happy, we don't feel the pain as much. But when we're under stress and we've got more cortisol, you know, going around, we're going to feel pain, which started to make me think, and I haven't done any investigation, I just started to think, when teams are losing regularly, are injury rates higher, not because of bad training, but because of stress that leads to the injury? Because you know what we always see, most of the time, that teams that are successful have lower injury rates. But is that because of better practitioners and better training methods, or is that a consequence of winning?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because if you look at stress or fear of not being good enough, people would have their, if you look at the breathing rhythm, it would be more higher up.
Mm.
So that means that you keep your spine stiff, so some parts are not moving as it should. So then it's an obvious result that your body is going to adapt. It's not used to it. So then it's obvious to me that some kind of injuries could happen. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So, I mean, how does it affect your everyday life now? So you obviously journal, read far and wide, but your model of keeping yourself on track, you know, emotionally and psychologically, how do you put it all together?
Well, if I take yesterday, for example, I get up. I mean, I bought this nice wake-up light because now the winter is starting here, so I need to get some kind of sunrise effect to wake me up. So that's how I start today. And then yesterday, I did a bit of yoga, and then prepared myself, did a bit of reading. And then during the day, it's not that you need to have a massive amount of time to manage your energy a bit better. So after doing a task for 50 or 90 minutes, your body needs a break cognitively. You can't focus for longer than 90 minutes on one task. So then I just take a break for 5 minutes and just sit, relax, and then go on again. And in the evening, I try to use a lot of guided meditations lately. But before that, I managed to, like you wrote in your self-science book, that switch off the TV or my phone before a certain amount of time. I actually check my messages only in the morning. I haven't checked my messages this morning because I don't want that input before our meeting.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Is that difficult for you?
It was in the beginning, but now I change my WhatsApp status. Urgent calls only. I reply whenever I want, not when my phone wants me to reply. So I switched off all my notifications.
Mm.
And I put my sound on for people that want to call me. And if I don't want to be disturbed, I just switch off my phone.
And what about social media apps? How do you deal with
that? That's an interesting one, because now I started as an entrepreneur from the 1st of July. And I was like, okay, I need to get some social media activity going. I started doing Instagram, but I was spending too much time to find the right posts on Instagram or Facebook. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to do that. I think that most of my potential clients are on LinkedIn or Twitter. And I just write whatever I feel like writing. And if people read it, that's fine. Mm. If they don't read it, that's fine too. So I try to limit that. And then I think the good thing that an iPhone gives you is your screen time at the end of the week.
Yeah, what are you up to?
2 hours, I think, now.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah. In actual fact, one of the things that I find, that's very good, 2 hours. And if you want to work on your screen time, one of the best things is to get a group of friends and to make it a competition. And because you can get it down. And I think with some of us, like I know me, and a lot of my friends were a bit competitive, so that might be the best form to really reduce it. And because it's I'm not anti the phone or anything like that, but if it's not adding to your life and it's subtracting, and And look, none of us have the cognitive power to overcome the amount of effort that social media platforms have put into keeping us on the platform.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's many smarter people than us working to keep us on that platform, and we are not wired well enough to deny that. So I think we need to be very aware. Okay, so you're talking about being an entrepreneur now. Where do you see yourself in five years? What's the, you know, you wake up, you're living your dream life. What does it look like?
That's a good question. We spoke about this before and didn't really have an answer at that time. What I really enjoy doing, and I hope to be doing that still in 5 years' time, is coaching and mentoring people to get the maximum potential out of themselves.
Yeah.
Whether that's in sport or any other high performance environment. If you look at business, the way, for example, a sales department works, I don't think that's much different than any kind of high performance sport, because they still want to compete. They're working in teams, they need to work together with other people and still manage themselves and get results at the end of it. So if I look at an ideal scenario, I would not have any coaching sessions on a Monday to start the week easy, get ease into the week, get my administration done. And then on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday would be my main coaching sessions that I work with people one-on-one. Having my own practice, so I could work more body-oriented, which is easier having your own practice than doing it online. However, I found, due to the COVID situation, that still able to do a lot of body-oriented work online. And then on Friday, I would also schedule no meetings in the morning, but I'd still have some space to finish some work that I haven't been able to do at the beginning of the week. And then besides that, I like to enjoy coaching football. I'm not sure whether that's going to be full-time or part-time in football, but the way I've managed my situation now is one that I'm very happy with, because I could coach one-on-one with people, and then in the afternoon I would have my practice session with the kids on the field, and then that's when you go outside and then switch off, because you're working with the kids only, and then on Saturday you would have your games. But besides that, I managed to learn my body a bit better, so I know what I have to do when I feel a bit depleted, instead of just taking a coffee and go on with it.
So in
that kind of way, I know that yoga, for example, and meditation is probably much better for my body than going for a cycle 3 times a week for 3 hours, because that would deplete my energy, and then I wouldn't be able to do my work as well as I can. Because, like, as working as a body-oriented psychologist or a coach or a football coach, having that empathy, that's related to your emotional intelligence. So if you're very depleted, you can't link with other people. So that's my key focus for me to one, keep the relationship with myself good, so I can have a very good relationship with others. Because if the first one isn't good, as it used to be, you can't have any good connection with the people that you're working with, living with, or like having a laugh with.
I agree. It's what I say to leaders. You know, I really think, you know, great leadership starts with very good self-leadership.
You know, exactly.
If you're not right, and that's why, I don't know if I told you this a couple of years ago, I started to look at coaches and sports scientists and high performance managers and thought, wow, you guys, we don't look very healthy. There's something wrong with that. And, you know, here we are monitoring the players. And then I started to go, hey, I need to monitor these coaches, and I need to monitor these people and getting data from them, because they were the ones not sleeping well. They were the ones, and they're the decision makers. So if self-leadership is right, how possibly can the decision-making be right, you know, in a crisis situation? And often you see coaches explode on the sideline or explode at training, and you think, okay, where are they at in respect to taking care of self?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, if I could recap it a little bit, I mean, in 5 years' time, I hope to be an expert with having a good relationship with myself and knowing myself, but also being an expert in coaching like high professionals and high performance towards a better self-management in teams. I think that's the key factor that I want to, specialize myself in. And body-oriented psychology is one of the methods that I'm trying to implement in.
No, it's been really fantastic, Guido, speaking to you. What about the PhD? You think that might be a different topic now?
It is, but if I look back at it, I was very interested in the topic, not necessarily in having a PhD. I was because it was in line with my master research topic, and I was really interested in doing that. But I was like, okay, I could still do that even from a distance, and or just implement that in any practical environment. It's not that I just want to do research and type something. However, my master thesis is used for a journal, and together with another part of research, and they put it into publication now. So we're waiting for the review process, but it's probably going to be out soon. It's based on coach behavior and coach feedback. It's very interesting.
Well, that's fantastic. Look, I'll get all your, we'll put all the links into the notes for this episode anyway, so people can get in contact with you. Because I know a lot of people that listen to this, you know, are obviously involved in football, but also in really focusing on enhancing themselves. And I think it's been really interesting, this entire conversation, your journey. And you're very wise. I remember when I first met you as well, and I think that travel and that has really enhanced that. And and different cultures really makes a difference, doesn't it? I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, being abroad definitely give me time, and also like experiencing different cultures. You get to know yourself very well in that kind of. When you're really out of your comfort zone, that's when you get to know yourself.
Yeah. One last question: your guided meditation. What one do you use? Do you have one that you use?
Just YouTube, really. I know, I think Jason Stevenson, he's actually an Australian guy. I enjoy listening to. I like to have a bit of freedom instead of using an app. I know you recommended an app in your self-science book.
Yeah, but I think I give people the option, like, you know, at the moment, I find meditation hard, but I know it's really important for me. I think Tara Brock is really good, and you know, there's a few people, but I think like you, it's just a matter of being still. And there's a number of people on YouTube. I've actually recently, you know, because I'm using the Aura Ring, they've got a really nice a couple of nice guided meditations on that. That's really helped me. That can make all the difference.
At the end, I would like to give two book recommendations that changed my perspective a little bit on my journey when I was abroad. So this is one. I don't know if you know.
The Alchemist.
Which is interesting.
A classic book, actually. Yes, we should definitely recommend that. I'll put that in there.
Yeah. And this one, especially if there's any leaderships in business, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari.
I haven't read that. So that's a really good, you enjoyed that?
Yeah, it's a very good book. It's about a lawyer that's very successful and then gets a heart attack in court. And then he just sells everything and goes over to India to practice as a monk.
Yeah, incredible. Because that's what it's all about, isn't it? You know, really not what you're doing now, but, you know, at the end of life, you know, and I talk about that in self-science, you know, at the end of life, you're going to sit there and ask yourself the question, did I live the life that I want? And my wish is that people don't have any regret.
Yeah.
And that starts now, I suppose. So, you know, fantastic. Anything else? Any last things you want to say?
No, I just want to say thanks for having me. It's very good talking to
you. Yeah. And
even offline, I hope that we continue this chat.
Of course. Of course we will. Anyway, Thanks, everyone. And as always, thanks for, you know, to tuning into the Dr. Craig Duncan podcast. And it's great to have Guido sit on here today. And I'll give you all his details, so he'd be happy if you get in contact with him. Anyway, till next time, go and make the world a better place. Yeah.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you really enjoyed that episode. I know I did, and I'm sure we'll have Guido on again just to have a chat. He's a really interesting person and making a real difference in the area of human performance. As always, I hope you are well, and you probably know by now, but I have a new book, Self Science, and it is available, and you can follow the links in any of my bios or on my website to find out how you can purchase that. And recently I did an episode where I actually read the first chapter of Self Science, so you can listen to that. I think it's episode 140. Anyway, you can also get in contact with Guido. The links are in the show notes of this episode, so please do. He'll be really happy to reply if you've got any more questions on any aspect of his career and also body-orientated psychotherapy. Anyway, as always, have an amazing day and go and make the world a better place.